Hello, welcome back to Music Ally Focus with me, Music Ally's editor, Joe Sparrow. And in this episode, we're joined by Adam Webb from Fanfare Alliance, which is a UK-based organisation campaigning, it says, against industrial-scale online ticket touting. I chatted to Adam about the state of event ticketing in the UK, particularly secondary ticketing, and what the Fanfare Alliance sees as the most pertinent issues that need fixing and changing at the moment. Now, you may have noticed that there has been an unseasonal pause in the Music Ally Focus podcast's activities. That's because we have been beavering away diligently behind the scenes to launch the brand spanking new Music Ally website, which is spruced up and better than ever. Visit it at musically.com, that's musically.com, and behold, gaze at its wondrous, colourful nature, and you'll become, to quote Radiohead, fitter, happier, and more productive immediately. Now, each Music Ally Focus episode analyzes one meaningful music business story at a time. And this podcast, therefore, is going to be quick. It'll take the same amount of time as Bippin Larkin and Ashrita Furman could throw 2,500 shaving cream pies. They threw 50 in 30 seconds in 2016. And it's important to note that Bippin was the thrower for this attempt and Ashrita was the receiver. Now, talking of tackling a sticky situation, Fanfare Alliance aims to tackle the giant industry of secondary ticket touting, or scalping, if you prefer. Supported by managers and teams for artists, including Arctic Monkeys, Ed Sheeran, Biffy Clyro, Pixies, Iron Maiden, George Ezra, and many more, Fanfare, it says, has successfully helped change the regulatory and legislative landscape in the UK, leading to the widespread adoption of consumer-friendly practices for ticket resale. So we had a good chat with Adam about what it sees as the main problems around ticket touting on this grand scale in the UK. He talks as well a little bit about the landscape in the US and the differences between them. It's a really good and interesting conversation, so let's go over to it right now. So we are very happy to welcome Adam Webb from the Fanfare Alliance to the Focus podcast. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm very good, and all the better to see you. Now, you've written a couple of guest posts for us in the past. We've featured news about the Fanfare Alliance. Can you just, for a bit of extra context, give the listeners an overview of the Fanfare Alliance, what it campaigns for, how it does it, and whose side are you on?
Whose side are we on? So the campaign was actually started, I mean, quite a while ago now. So it was mid-2016. And just to set a bit of context, at that time, a new Consumer Rights Act had been introduced, actually the year earlier in 2015, which sort of introduced some sort of light touch regulations around the resale of tickets, really to try and help consumers identify what they were actually buying on the secondary ticketing market. And back then we always talked about the big four secondary ticketing websites, which was Viagogo, the market leader in inverted commas, which is privately owned. But at the time, there was StubHub, which was owned by eBay. And then there were two sites owned by Ticketmaster. So obviously the biggest primary ticket seller was also involved in the secondary market, which again caused you know, a difficult sort of set of dynamics, basically. And essentially, all of these sites are pretty similar in terms of business model. They're all dominated by large-scale ticket sellers, whether you want to call them touts, scalpers, or brokers, or whatever. But that's the majority of the people listing tickets on those platforms. And actually, the competition in this market was mostly between the platforms to see who could attract the biggest sellers to sell the biggest volumes. So at the time, we had the four platforms and we had new legislation that was brought in to try and bring some new transparency into this market. So if, when you were buying a ticket, you would know the original face value of the ticket. You would know the location of a seat. So you'd be given the block, the row and the seat number. And you'd also be given any information around the restrictions of use of the ticket, like, you know, if you had to go for 14 or if there were any restrictions around the reuse of the ticket and the resale of the ticket. So at the time, the legislation was introduced. And as far as we could tell, there was zero compliance with the legislation. So not only could you not find this information out, but there was also a bunch of other consumer legislation that wasn't being adhered to. And there was also a lot of bad practice in terms of, and actually particularly with Viagogo, where you get sort of pop-up screens, fake loading bars, you know, I mean, basically everything was there to sort of, you know, I think really to missell you a ticket, basically. So the campaign sort of started off, a number of management companies started it. And again, a lot of those had had an interest in this, in the secondary market for some time in terms of you know, hearing from fans on a fairly regular basis that they'd been misled, that they'd been missold to, that they'd bought tickets from an online tout, basically. And I think that there was a view that this legislation, this could be really the first key to try and reform this market and try and grow a different kind of resale market where, a more consumer-friendly resale market where you could only resell a ticket for the price you paid or less. And again, that's something I think that's been really positive in the UK. We've now got quite a lot of those services, which is a really good thing. So back then we had a number of management companies. They decided, right, we're going to put some resources in, we're going to have a campaign, and we're going to try and get this legislation enforced. So that was really the first step. And then I was brought in to basically run that campaign. I think grow the level of support. So now Fanfare, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different people who've sort of signed up to the campaign or agreed to join the campaign. Obviously loads of management companies, but also agents, promoters, venues, festivals. So I think it's been a bit of a sort of a coalition of the willing. And then I think just because this market is quite complex and there's been a lot of different, you know, there's been regulators and politicians and others involved in it, actually the work that Fanfare did actually sort of snowballed really. So we started, one of the first things that happened was that the Competition and Markets Authority, the UK's regulator, actually decided to have an enforcement investigation into the websites. I think they could quite clearly see that the law wasn't really adhered to. So again, there was a lot of work with them, putting evidence in. We had the DCMS Select Committee looking at the market. And again, myself and others were involved in providing evidence to them. We had the Advertising Standards Authority involved to look at things like pressure selling and the way tickets were advertised. Loads of conversations with Google, because that's probably another chapter in its own right in terms of how these sites play Google to attract customers. And also, like I say, I think overall trying to work with particularly with management companies and others in the industry, I think really to try and work out how the rules of ticketing can be better explained to customers, and also to promote this idea that, you know, you should allow resale. It's a really good thing, but it's capped and it's for the price that you paid or less, and working out how best to, you know, put that before the customer.
I mean, I think a lot of people who are listening who've bought a ticket or have been through these systems would feel very sympathetic to that. For clarity's sake, say, well, what if someone's listening and saying, well, this is the free market, right? We can, like, yes, regulation around selling and advertising, understand that. But like if someone wants to resell the ticket for five times the face value, isn't that the market? I mean, so why is, in your opinion, this approach, the sort of the right approach,
I think primarily because, well, obviously there's various laws in place, and if those are being broken, they need to be enforced. Yeah. And I think that's been the real sea change in the UK, that there actually has been at least some enforcement. I mean, I'd argue probably not enough, and there's areas where it could be improved. But you know, again, I think it was a really interesting one, because I think back in 2013, 14, when Saeed Javid was the culture secretary, he came out actually saying, I think Sharon Hodgson, the Labour MP who chairs the APPG on ticket abuse and had a private members bill trying to basically outlaw resale over face value. This was being debated in Parliament, and Saeed Javid essentially said, well, you know, these people are just, you know, these are just entrepreneurs, you know, trying to make a living. They're just buying and selling goods. You know, what's wrong with that? And I think, you know, there's a spectrum of opinion, and certainly in terms of the US and a more free market opinion where, you know, there will be that belief, absolutely. And certainly from ticket touts, they will love to believe that. Yes. They'll say that, you know, it's a good, you can, it's like a banana, you can do anything like that. I think that there's a few fundamental differences. I mean, aside from it being a cultural good, and that there's a need an overall need to, I guess, to protect this market and to make sure it's got a diversity of audiences, and you're bringing in new audiences, And, you know, you've got artists who are, you know, they're the ones who are establishing the ticket prices, and they are the competition in this market. You've also got, you know, you have got a bunch of consumer laws which are there to protect consumers and to stop them being ripped off and exploited. That was clearly happening to a, you know, to a really, really bad degree, and lots of people being ripped off in this market. So I think fundamentally they were the reasons. But I think as well that, that a ticket, it's very difficult to define what a ticket is, but what you find with most, well, pretty much every single promoter, certainly to large scale events or you know, large scale ticketed events, is the ticket is defined as a license. So basically that is what you're buying as a ticket. It's not a piece of paper. It's not a good, it's the license to enter the venue, which is being sold to you by the promoter. So that's the sort of the intangible IP that you're buying as a ticket. And there are rules attached to those tickets. as well as the law of the land, the promoters themselves will attach rules to those tickets. So again, it's really, really important that, you know, that those rules are not just stuck in, you know, sort of legalese and pages and pages of small print, but, you know, if there's really important things around the rules of entry, that those things are really made really, really clear when you buy the ticket, including how you can resell the ticket. So I think there was a lot in this market that sort of needed to improve, as well as making sure it was functioning and it was lawful, also making it more consumer friendly. And I think there's definitely a long way to go, because again, it's such an important market. Obviously it's certainly pre-pandemic, a lot bigger than the recorded industry and the recorded market. So it's really important, I think, that, you know, that everyone gets this right, and we have a proper functioning market which consumers are happy in. Obviously, if they're unhappy, there's lots of different things they can spend their money on.
And you've touched on this here already to some extent, but what is, from your perspective, the state of ticketing, secondary ticketing in the UK right now? And what does Fanfare Alliance is perhaps, you said there's a long way to go, but what is perhaps the next most pertinent issue that could be fixed?
I'm definitely more of a sort of glass half full. And I think the big achievements in terms of the UK are, and again, not saying in any way that things are perfect, but if you compare, say, Viagogo.co.uk with Viagogo.com or any of the other versions of Viagogo, you'll see quite plainly some of the differences which our campaign has helped to change. So if you look on the sort of international versions of Viagogo.com, you don't get any information about the face value price. You don't get any information about who the sellers might be. You're bombarded with, you know, weird pop-up screens, fake loading bars, pressure, all these kind of pressure selling techniques. So all of those things have been sort of eradicated from Viagogo in the UK, operating in the UK. There's definitely things there where I think if the CMA did some consumer research, it's still quite hard to find certain information, which I think should be made clearer, but there has been a lot of improvements. I think the second thing is that Ticketmaster in the UK have moved out of secondary ticketing. So unlike in the US, where, you know, they are embedded in the secondary market, and, you know, working and allowing large-scale ticket brokers to resell tickets on their platform, Ticketmaster took the decision, and the correct decision, I think, and a brave decision in the UK to move out of that market. So like all the other primary ticketing companies in the UK, they now operate a capped resale platform, which is really good. So in terms of the primary industry, everyone is now the right side of the line, and sort of offering a similar thing to customers. So if you can't go, you can resell your ticket with us, or they'll work with a third party specialist, or, you know, you've got companies like Dice, Resident Advisor. You know, there's actually a lot more. You know, we talked about the big four secondary ticketing companies. There's actually loads of companies now which allow you to resell for the price that you paid. So that's a really, really good thing. I think that we're sort of ahead of the game in that regard.
And that's one of the sort of pertinent things of what you're saying, isn't it, here, which is it's like a lot of things in the modern online world, it's about us individuals who have access to a phone and want to do something, versus an enormous multi-billion-dollar machine that is fine-tuned to make us be steered perhaps in the direction of the company that wants us to do that. And that's the imbalance, I guess, is what you're saying at the heart of this, is that these are technologically attuned things that are stretching the boundaries of what a secondary ticket is.
Exactly, and it's been an interesting one within fanfare as well, because obviously there's artists which are really quite, you know, who are quite militant about this, really, who, you know, really want to go to the nth degree to, you know, to protect their fans. And so, you know, again, it's like they set the ticket price. This is the ticket price we want to sell to you at. If you want to resell, do it here, and don't do it here. And, you know, artists like Ed Sheeran, Arctic Monkeys, Iron Maiden. Yeah. There's lots of artists who again feel very passionate about this. Clearly, there'll be other artists who feel a lot less passionate about it. Certainly, a lot of American artists, I suspect. And again, I think where I think it's got interesting now is because there's this divide, I think, between a US perspective on this and a UK and European perspective, is that in the US, because you've now got this trend towards dynamic ticket pricing, so you're trying to find, in inverted commas, a market-based price, which can only really be gauged by the secondary ticketing market, which then means that you need the secondary ticketing market as a barometer to set your ticket prices. This creates a bit of a problem, I think, in the UK, because on the one side, you've got artists who are trying to cap prices, make things clear for fans. And on the other side, if you want to dynamically price, again, you know, sometimes this has been sold as sort of like an anti-touting strategy, but it's not. It's a way of generating more money. But to have dynamic pricing, you need to have something to compare it against, which is the secondary market. And I think this is where it's now slightly getting tied up in knots, because at the same time as big companies like Live Nation are trying to, again, quite rightfully, try to put a squeeze on secondary ticketing and some of the bad practices in the US, and they're coming out and saying, you know, there's a lot of these tickets are speculative, they don't exist, you know, there's lots of bad practice here, you can't trust this market. But at the same time, they're also using that market as a barometer to dynamic price tickets. That doesn't really quite add up for me as a consumer proposition, I think, or I think it's a difficult one anyway to square.
You wrote a guest post for us last year about dynamic ticketing, and I'll link to that beneath the podcast for people to read and catch up on. There's an interesting dynamic there, isn't there? You mentioned that a bunch of artists, you mentioned Arctic Monkeys, Ed Sheeran, Iron Maiden, but I've got a list here, Keen, PJ Harvey, George Ezra. You know, they're all very keen to keep the ticket price at what they set in the first place, right? That's and for their fans, that feels great. But then there's also artists who are... the famous example, of course, is Bruce Springsteen, who are sort of happily embracing dynamic prices. And what does that mean? You've got this sort of split between sort of artist approaches. Does it actually, the artists that are embracing dynamic ticketing, is that sort of letting them off the hook a bit? Because they can sell tickets at a certain price, knowing that they're actually going to go at another.
It's a really difficult one, I think. I mean, as fanfare and as a campaign, I mean, it's not something actually we you know, the campaign never really had a position on dynamic. I think it's only because it's been pushed in some quarters as being a sort of an antidote to secondary. It's not actually a way to stop secondary. It's actually a way to make money from secondary. So it's to help, I suppose, realize the value of not leave money on the table from secondary, which isn't quite the same thing as stopping it. I think what's happened in the UK now has actually empowered artists. So if they want to try and stop secondary, they can do it. I think it should be made a lot easier for those artists, and they should have a lot more support. And there's probably more technological solutions for them to do that, which would be helpful. But I think that, yeah, it's a challenging one. And clearly, you know, there'll be some artists who, because this is so commonplace in the US, it's almost like everybody in the US dynamically prices tickets. So it's quite a complicated picture, I think. And again, one thing we always talked about at the start of fanfare was, like, you know, again, it's very much up to the artist in terms of how, you know, what price they put on their tickets. That's very much down to them. And as long as they're being, you know, as long as you're being upfront and clear about, you know, how things work and so on, That's pretty much their business. That wasn't what our campaign was really to get involved in. And again, I think that becomes an issue when, you know, the pricing is quite unclear a lot of the time, and it does become incredibly complex. You know, when artists cap their prices and you know what the prices are and you know what the rules of resale are, it's a lot easier than when there's a, you know, when there's this sort of like multitude of shifting prices and you're never quite sure, you know, what the ticket price is. So, you know, it becomes complex.
What about then something else that you've been talking about recently, which is speculative ticketing?
Mm-hmm.
So what is that? Just for anyone who doesn't fully understand it.
I mean, essentially, it's fraud. It's where ticket touts list tickets on the secondary platforms, which they don't possess, and then they, you know, they'll take an order and then they'll fulfil it from the primary market. We've had loads of instances with this, particularly on Viagogo, last year, I did quite a big in-depth investigation with ITV, where we found there were three ticket sellers on Viagogo, all based in the north of England, and the three of them were responsible for about 75% of all the festival listings on Viagogo, festival and outdoor music events. It became fairly clear because of the patterns that those tickets were listed in. It looked incredibly suspicious. Then after chatting and talking to a lot of the festivals and also by doing some test purchases, we found quite clearly that those people did not have those tickets, that they were, you know, they were committing basically large scale fraud on those platforms. In the UK, if you're a business, you have to declare you're a business when you sell something. So if you're a professional trader on eBay or Amazon Marketplace, you have to declare yourself. It's the same on Viagogo or StubHub as well. So because of that, we actually can identify who some of these people are, or the fact that they are businesses. I think when you move into the US or other countries where either these laws aren't being enforced or these laws aren't there, you don't know who you're buying from. So it's like a peer-to-peer marketplace where you've got, it's completely anonymous. So you actually don't know who's selling the tickets or whether the tickets even exist. I suspect in the US, this is absolutely, you know, this is massive. So again, it's very difficult to actually gauge even what the size of the secondary ticketing market is. When the CMA CMA did some really good research on this a few years ago, and this the documentation sort of redacted, but it suggests that Viagogo and StubHub are saying to the CMA, saying to the regulator, that the secondary ticketing market in the UK is worth up to £2.5 billion a year, which would be an astonishing amount. The CMA actually, when they look at this and look at the numbers, they say actually we think this market's worth £350 million a year. So again, there's this huge disparity between the optics, which look like it's absolutely massive, and there's loads of tickets. The reality is, when you drill into it, actually a lot of those tickets have never been purchased. So it looks like the
tree. Right. So it's the hypothetical tickets
exactly
are inflating the market, but they're not actually there or being sold or and
obviously, you know, these companies want to IPO, they want to gain investors, so it suits them to look like the tree is full of tickets. Actually, it's a little bit of a threadbare kind of bush, really, I think. So and actually, this was one of the things which the CMA, agreed, you know, they've seen the evidence, they've read the news reports. You know, it wasn't just with festivals, this was happening at grassroots venues, all kinds of places, or particularly on Viagogo. So this was one area where the CMA actually made some recommendations to the UK government back in August 2021, basically to say that, look, we've done quite a lot to fix this market, but there's a real problem here with speculative ticketing. We want some extra powers, some changes to the law to give us more power. And one of those really was basically for sites like Viagogo and StubHub to basically verify whether those people selling the tickets actually had the tickets, which, you know, sounds like it could be a bit onerous. But when you sort of consider that, again, those sites, you know, they're reliant upon, I don't know, a hardcore of, say, 100, maybe a couple of 100 commercial sellers. It's not a very big ask to ask some of these people, you know, you're listing thousands and thousands of festival tickets. Let's see the receipts, please. That's really, really fundamentally what they were trying to do. But unfortunately, governments rejected those recommendations. Still not quite sure why. But it's that kind of thing, I think, again, would really help clear up this market. And again, really help consumers, I think, in terms of, again, you know, the whole point about this is they're meant to be gaining a better understanding of what they're buying, who they're buying it from, and also the fact that they're buying something that actually exists, not something that, you know, is a fraudulent listing.
Yeah. That's a remarkable statistic that it's a handful of people who are in control of such a large proportion of the festival market.
It came up in, there's a legal action taking place in New Zealand against Viagogo. I mean, there's multiple actions particularly against that company. And again, the statistic comes up time and time again that 90% of the tickets being sold are by professional ticket touts. You know, these aren't consumer to consumer platforms. They're business to consumer platforms. And I think, you know, in very much the same way as something like Airbnb, you know, it starts with a sort of utopian vision of sort of consumers interacting with the consumers. After time, they evolve, and it just becomes another sort of hotel platform, or people become professional landlords by default. Kind of thing. And I think it's similar with these platforms that, you know, people become professional ticket touts by default almost.
Interesting. You said you're a glass half full kind of guy. So, in my experience, I think you are. So, what are the developments? What's going on around secondary ticketing that makes you feel positive as you look ahead?
I think the technology is there to, the technology is there to stop ticket touts getting tickets in the first place. I mean, that's the fundamental thing. If you can stop that, and if you can keep tickets in the hands of fans, then obviously that's sort of solves a lot of the problem. So I think that the technology is there, and there's always advances being made in technology. So that's one positive, I think. And I think as well that technology also changes sort of what a ticket is as well, because it's not just the license to get into a show. It can be a lot of other things as well. And clearly, again, this is where, I know people talk about, super fans and they try and sort of segment fans, et cetera. But, to me, live music and buying tickets, it's still the best barometer we've got of what is, what's great art, what's success, think things which I think become very difficult in the streaming environment where, you can talk about millions of streams and it doesn't necessarily mean anything. I think to actually get people out the house buying tickets to go to a show, that's a really important measurement of what success is, what longevity is, and sort of how good something is as well. So I think it's really important to get that right. And it's still something which, there's excitement and passion around, which I don't think you necessarily get around the release of recorded music, because, it's not the era anymore where people, queue around the block, around the record shop, apart from record store day. Whereas I think that obviously with live music, there's still that, huge passion and excitement, which is again one of the reasons why there's so many controversies around ticketing as well. So
right, but that passion is what drives the people to try and find loopholes in the system.
Absolutely.
And do you feel like you said it's a very multifaceted problem that you're trying to take on, an issue. Do you feel that, and obviously when you start involving legislation, it takes a very long time to get things done, and companies can move much more quickly than legislation. But do you feel that the weight of momentum is sort of behind at least your sort of broader approach now of making things better for fans?
Absolutely. And, obviously not everything relies on legislation. And I think two of the things that would make a massive difference would be better communication from the music industry about where tickets are on sale, who's selling tickets, what the prices are, how you resell. I mean, all that kind of stuff to sort of, build more trust with the audience.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, one of the other elephant in the rooms is actually Google as well. And research that we've done suggests that most people who are looking for tickets, they first go to Google. And because the secondary ticketing companies tend to buy the top of search, that is still a really, really big problem, because I think whatever improvements are made, when you've still got people being herded and directed towards secondary ticketing sites rather than the legitimate sources of tickets, obviously it means A, you're going to sell less tickets because you're sending people in the wrong direction, But you're also, you're leading people to where, you know, there's overpriced tickets, sometimes, outright scam sites. You know, it's quite problematic. And I think, we have had at various times, we've had a lot of support from Google and a lot of help from Google. But I think there's a real role there for them to become, more of an aggregator and to try and help their customers and music fans actually find legitimate sources of tickets.
You mean like a sort of Google Flights for tickets?
Well, everyone's seen the changes in recorded music. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where you were being, you Google an artist name and a track and you were directed straight towards Pirate Bay. I mean, now you've got a whole section of Google where it's sending you towards licensed music sites, recorded music sites.
Right.
I don't think it would be a massive step to do the same for ticketing. And actually there's, obviously there's some really brilliant aggregators out there, sites like Songkick, Bands in Town, etc. But again, I think that there's more information that can be there on those websites. I mean, resale is certainly something that's absent, and again, helping people to understand where you buy tickets. Most people will be unaware that, for most big shows, there's probably, two, three, four official ticket agents. They might only know one. So they might go to one of the agents and it's sold out and they think, oh, it's sold out. But actually, there's two ticket agents over here who've still got inventory to buy. Yeah. So it's all that kind of stuff to help, help consumers navigate this market and make it easier for them, which again, for the longevity of the business, I think is, there's only upsides to that. So.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, like I say, I will put links to the Fanfare Alliance and your previous guest posts you've written for us. I think we have one or two in the archive beneath this podcast. But before you go, Adam, the final question is, we've talked a lot about music business, but let's talk about music. One question, which is, if you could only pick one piece of music to take with you for the rest of your life, I'm willing to vacillate between either a song or an album, but what would it be?
Oh my goodness. I had something in my head before we started this conversation and now it's completely gone from my head.
Good.
So
spontaneous responses are good.
I would say probably the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, I think.
That's a good, that's a good choice. I've been thinking about this because sometimes people pick a classic like that, which you're just going to get richness out of every time you listen to it.
Indeed.
Then some people pick one that is one that they think they're going to get a lot of value out of. Every time they hear it, they hear something else. So I don't think there's a correct route. This is an open question, but I think a lot of people would agree with you on that one.
Yeah,
I'm
probably going to regret that answer in about 5 minutes, and I might just ask you to re-record that part possibly.
If you change your mind, email me and I'll put the alternative alongside Pet Sounds beneath the podcast as well.
Thank you very much.
So if you suddenly remember that actually it was something by Atari Teenage Riot, we can drop that in.
How did you know they were my second choice?
Yes. All right, Adam Webb from Fanfare Alliance, thanks very much.
Nice one. Thanks, Jay.
All right, there we are. Big thank you to Adam Webb for talking to us. And I will put a link to a bunch of things, including the Fanfare Alliance and the guest posts that he has written for Music Ally beneath the podcast. If you found that useful, please share it on with someone else who you think will get something out of it. And if you want to get in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at joe@musically.com. That's Joe, J-O-E, @musically.com. There is a link to that beneath the podcast as well. We also have a free weekly email called The Knowledge, which rounds up bits and pieces of all the analysis, news, marketing insight, and skills that Music Ally whelps on a regular basis. So sign up by the link that is below the podcast and impress your friends. That's it. So thank you for listening. As ever, I've been Joe Sparrow. You've been you. And until next time, farewell.